Stranger Things' fourth season wrapped up this weekend. Those kids on bikes we met in season one are scattered to the four winds. We got some major revelations about the origin of the Upside Down and its sundry monsters. We met the big bad of the series and got a few hints as to his dastardly plan. And we got teed up for the show's fifth and final season. I'm Glenn Weldon, and today we're talking about the latest season of the Netflix series Stranger Things on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Joining me today is Ronald Young Jr. He's the host of the film and television review podcast, Leaving the Theater. Hey, Ronald.
Hello, Glenn.
So season four was divided into two chunks. The first seven episodes dropped in May and saw the various cast members split into different storylines. And on Friday, we got the two-episode conclusion with a finale episode that ran almost 2.5 hours. We'll be talking about the entire season, so consider this your spoiler warning. So, Millie Bobby Brown's Eleven returns to Dr. Brenner, played by Matthew Modine, and gets her powers back. Her boyfriend Mike, played by Finn Wolfhard, and her friend Will, played by Noah Schnapp, attempt to rescue her. Back in Hawkins, there's a malevolent presence killing kids, and its next victim looks to be Sadie Sink's Max, who can only protect herself by listening to Running Up That Hill, her favorite song, by Kate Bush. The spate of gruesome murders has Hawkins in the grip of satanic panic and mistakenly blaming the D&D-playing metalhead kid Eddie, played by Joseph Quinn. Meanwhile, in Russia, David Harbour's Hopper is imprisoned in a gulag. Joyce, played by Winona Ryder, and Murray, played by Brett Gelman, set out to rescue him. Ronald, this was a big season, a lot of moving parts. What'd you make of it?
I liked this season. I was a big fan of season three. I think they added new characters and they had them going on adventures in a way that wasn't just focused on the core four.
Right.
And I think that kind of expansion gives the show some longevity. But I will say them working in separate groups for seemingly separate objectives at times was a little weary.
Mm-hmm.
One group, and specifically we're talking about the Running Up the Hill group that has Dustin, and it has
Steve.
And Lucas, mm-hmm. and Max, all of them, I think they're really advancing the plot most of this season. And so when we cut away to other people doing anything, in some cases even Eleven doing things, mm-hmm. I was just like, no, get back to what is Dustin doing? I want to see what Dustin's doing all the time. But as the season goes on, it kind of paid off, and they began to bring it closer and closer together. So I enjoyed that. I enjoyed this season. I will say I'm wondering how it all ends, uh-huh. because I feel like the big bad of this season was so big and so bad. If there's no other bad behind this bad, and we've already beat him, essentially, where do we go from here in season five?
Yeah, I'll take your point that dividing the season up in the way they did into these different storylines, you really get the sense of not all these characters are created equal.
Mm-hmm.
From a charisma perspective, it does seem like when you cordon off not just Dustin and Steve, but Robin and Erica,
yeah.
breakout star of the season,
yeah.
Erica and Max, and you get great additions to the cast, like you mentioned, like Eddie is a good addition, and Argyle.
Yes.
This show is set in the 80s. You need a Spicoli character. You need a stoner.
Yes.
That's when the show is firing on all cylinders. But as soon as an adult appears on screen, it just feels like, look, the contract I signed with this show is being violated. The organizing principle of this show. I was really glad to see the end of Dr. Brenner. I like Matthew Modine, but I feel like going back to that well didn't get us much of anything. It did give us, however, as you mentioned, our big bad, Henry Creel / Vecna / One. I think this is a great villain, and I think it's big enough to carry us into the next season. I'm really happy with this villain.
Make no mistakes. I think it's a good villain. I think one of the things that got me about this season was I remember as it was going, thinking, it seems unusual that the only person that has powers in this whole show is L,
yep.
is 11. You know what I mean? That's the only person who has powers. So with the big reveal that there is a one and there is all these other children who have powers, they're all dead except for one. And the other one who has the powers is the villain. So they're kind of opposing sides here, which makes sense. To have their big fight be in this season, season four, and us all knowing that season five is the final countdown. Mm-hmm. Like that's it for them. To me, I'm just saying, okay, so we're going to get round two. So my assumption is they're going to to have to do something to set L back again to then set them up for an even bigger final fight. And to me, it feels like they might have done that in season four already. So I feel like as a person who's been along with them for the ride the whole time, I guess I'm saying how much more danger could this town or these people or Eleven realistically be in when we kind of already know the full capacity of the big bad?
Yeah, well, that's another thing that's always tripped me up in this story. When the stakes are what's going to happen to Hawkins, right?
Yes.
It's never, look, I don't want everything to be Marvel Universe, the world's going to end, but when he says, and Hawkins will fall, it's like, I can't get my blood fired up for like a municipality, right? It's like, then I will take out the Chamber of Commerce and I will go after the woman who keeps the minutes at the council meetings. It's like, this is not it's not big enough. And I think that getting bigger and actually having it be a world threat or at least a nation threat will help.
But Glenn, do you think they could set all that up in a season five?
Of course they can. They keep restarting, right? They keep going back to zero. True. They keep taking away L's powers and then bringing them back. And we've met Eight, who's out there in the world.
Yeah.
I think the show doesn't know what it has on its hands, though. Like the Mike and Will storyline, you tell me that Mike is the heart of this group and Dustin is sitting right there. I'm sorry. I don't buy it. I just don't buy it.
You are 100% correct. As Will was giving that speech, I remember thinking a couple things. One, you could be the heart of this group more than Mike. And Mike was not giving me much this season at all. But the Duffer brothers, the directors, the camera, everyone loves Dustin. And I mean, there's two characters. Eddie and Steve are literally having a conversation about how much they love Dustin. You know, and like the chemistry with him and basically anyone on the screen who he's interacting with. I'm like, obviously, he is the heart of this group.
He fought and died to protect this town. This town that hated him. He isn't just innocent. Mr. Munson, he's a hero.
And at this point, it's almost to Mike's detriment at this point. And I'm wondering if I'm Finn Wolfhard's and Gaten Matarazzo's agents, I'd be like, hey, wait a minute. What are the salaries here? What's going on here? There's a clear star here and a clear co-star here. So we need to start thinking about this. So yeah, when they say that, I'm not buying it. I agree with you.
And let's talk about the Will storyline for a second. Mm-hmm. They are gesturing so broadly at this character's queerness that I think it's kind of pointless. I mean, I get that a lot of queer audiences want him to just be out and proud and get a better haircut. But I get what they're doing because, look, this kid in that time at his age would probably not come out. He would not, you know, rave a rainbow flag. I mean, I didn't. I was his age at that time. I had that haircut. I didn't come out.
Pictures.
But all this winking at the audience, it's just doing the character a disservice because it suddenly makes the character only that. Like, he only gets those speeches to be just that, and he doesn't have enough to do. It's reducing the character.
The thing about that storyline is it kind of went over my head. I had two thoughts. Mm-hmm. There's a scene where a girl reaches over with her foot and touches his foot, and he pulls away. And I was like, oh, is Will gay? But then the overarching thought was like, no, he has PTSD.
Right,
he was locked in the upside down. He don't have time to be messing with girls. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that was the message that I got. And I feel like if we completely forget the events of season one and two of this little boy who had an extremely traumatic experience, and then when it starts to become a story, a question of his sexuality, I almost feel like they should have just brought that out with more ease and not as much angst and just said, oh, yeah, and Will's gay. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he's still messed up from what's going on in the upside down.
Yep.
And I only say that because when you have a character that has had that much happen to them, it's going to be hard for me as the audience to look at it and say, well, is it about his sexuality, which it very well could be at that age, but also we just watched him, you know, be held captive by the Demigorgon and then held captive in his mind, essentially, by the Mind Flayer in the second season. You know what I mean? So, like, there could be 100 things going on with Will beyond his sexuality.
That would explain the haircut. Look, we have to talk about this. I referenced it at the top. Every time they'd cut away and I'd see snow, I'd be like, oh, time to check my phone. We were back in Russia. We were back at the Gulag. This has nothing to do with these actors. Harbour's great. Winona Ryder's great. Brett Gelman, great comic actor. It's no fault of the actors. And it does give Winona more to do than just stare at some Christmas lights.
Yes.
But, oof, the stakes of that story arc just aren't there.
No, and you're right. Every time they went to Russia, I mentally checked out as well. And I think what they did to Winona Ryder was, you know, in the past seasons, they kind of gave her an opportunity to kind of be a detective and figure it out. They gave her a little bit of that at the very beginning of season four. And then after that, she's kind of just along for the ride. Just another, you know, goon in the group, if you will. She's just hanging out, trying to go along with the prison heist and all that. And they still put most of the heavy lifting on the shoulders of Brett Gelman and David Harbour. And because I did not understand how what they were doing was connected to everyone else, by the climax of the show, I thought they would be back in Hawkins. Yeah. And because they weren't, it seems like they tried to convince us that what they were doing in Russia was important and vital to the fight. And even though they showed that it was, I was not convinced. I was convinced that what Steve, Robin, and Nancy were doing was way more vital to the fight and ended up being that was the case. Mm-hmm. And I think that's because, I mean, we signed paychecks. These people have contracts. And we put him in Russia. We wrote him into Russia at the end of season two. I guess we're going to spend the whole season getting him out, which, I mean, for me was a little exhausting. Again, I mentally checked out, you did. So I think next season they probably learned a lesson. But also with the cast being so big, I don't know. They're going to have to split them up again in season five.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, we don't know how much of it was COVID stuff.
Yes.
We don't know how much of it was the fact that they have to explain why David Harbour dropped all that Hellboy weight to get in shape. Yeah, I just don't think there was enough there. And when we find out that all they're doing is buying time, that doesn't seem like it's a payoff for an entire story arc. Talk to me about the Kate Bush of it all. The song Burning Up That Hill has soared up the charts. It's a song from the 80s. It's an amazing thing. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, it's hard to think about that song without thinking about Max, Sadie Sink, and how well she played that role. And I think that's kind of what sold the song to me, because during that episode, I was scared. Mm-hmm. I was attached to Max. I'm attached to the performance that she's giving. I felt like it was, you know, the stakes were there. And then you have this song from Kate Bush that comes on that is just, it's hitting the spot of the scene just so well. And of course, I went to Spotify. I put it on my summer playlist. Mm-hmm. I listened to it a couple of times. I'm just like, man, there's just something about the way that this song depicts a coming tragedy, maybe, but also like the idea of trying to, you know, like fight through it, the good fight and all that. It really congeals that part of the show. And it really props up Sadie's performance as Max a little bit more. And I certainly want to see her in more stuff. And I kind of don't know where her performance ends and her performance attached to the song begins. You know what I mean? Because I'm just sitting there looking at it. And I'm just like, give me more Sadie Sink. Put her in everything.
Definitely. And what the show did really well was set up the stakes for that particular moment. I think everything in the Hawkins section is really working here because those deaths that precede Max being in danger are gruesome and horrifying and old school, like scary 80s horror.
Yes.
And really serves it up well. And look, I'm of a certain age. The fact that the kids of today, like you, are discovering or rediscovering Kate Bush, that's a joy to me. Now, they've discovered one of her more mainstream hits, and there, I have to tell you, she was my patron saint in undergrad.
Okay.
So just check out the video for The Dreaming, which is a song that includes the lyrics, Banga goes another Kanga on the bonnet of the van. It's such a rich vein of artsy fartsiness, which is just exactly what I hungered for. As a kid getting a science degree, it makes me very, very happy. What song would save you from Vecna?
I am thinking right now, and I'm thinking kind of in the vein of the show, Maggie Rogers, Love You for a Long Time.
I love that. Love that choice.
Yeah, there's a lot of, if you listen to the beginning, there's a lot of driving beat in there. And if you listen to the lyrics, it just, it's a very romantic song. And it's funny because I feel like it could be a breakup song, but it also could be a new love type song as well. And so I like that it could be used in both moods, but it's such a soothing solve. So Maggie Rogers, Love You for a Long Time.
Solid, solid pick. Me, it's Love Goes to Building on Fire by Talking Heads.
Okay. I'm going to check that out.
You should check that out. So you're looking forward to season five?
I am. And I think we've kind of discussed a little bit of my hesitations, but I'm interested to see where they go. I mean, they've got me along for the ride. There's only one season left. I entered season four thinking that season four was the last season, and I was pleasantly surprised to find out that there's one more. Beyond season five, I'm interested to see what this cast does beyond Stranger Things. Mm-hmm. I think, obviously, Millie Bobby Brown is a star. You know, she's already started booking her in other things. She's in Enola Holmes, which I think the second one comes out later this year, if not next year. But I think watching all of their careers and seeing kind of like if they blossom from this, because they've grown up on this show into now nice, now young adult actors, and not just the kids, but also like the older kids, if you will, the ones who are already in their 20s playing high schoolers for some reason. I'm interested to see where all of their careers go after this, but I really am interested to see how the Duffer Brothers land the plane, and I trust that they'll do a good job.
Well, I hope so. I mean, it's going to be, you know, quite a while. We got a big wait for season 5, and they're probably going to divvy it up again, and they're probably going to do the same, you know, feature-length finale that they did.
Yeah.
Because they're wrapping everything up. This villain does call back to season 1, so there is a lot that feels like we are landing the plane, as you say.
Yeah.
Well, we want to know what you think about this season of Stranger Things. Find us at facebook.com/PCHH and on Twitter at PCHH. That brings us to the end of our show. Ronald Young Jr., thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Glenn.
And of course, thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. This episode was produced by Candace Lim and Mike Katziff and edited by Jessica Reedy. Hello Come In provides the music. You might be bobbing your head to. Maybe you're not. Who knows? I'm Glenn Weldon, and we'll see you all tomorrow when we will be talking about Thor, Love and Thunder.